Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 14th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Tombstone, Arizona case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. As we typically do, we'll hear brief opening remarks from each speaker, followed by an exchange between our speakers, followed by your questions. First up will be Mr. Nick Dranius. He's the director of the Center for Constitutional Government at the Goldwater Institute, and he represents the city of Tombstone in the case we're going to be discussing today. Second, we'll hear from Mr. Peter Appel, our Professor Peter Appel, who is a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law, where he teaches in the areas of property, natural resources law, and environmental law. Extensive bios for each speaker are available on our website, so why don't we turn right to the discussion. Mr. Dranius, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you, Peter. And to the audience, I really appreciate your attention to this critical matter. The City of Tombstone versus United States of America raises a critical existential question for the Western states. In the Western states, it is not uncommon for the typical states, such as Arizona, to have 70% or more of its lands still owned or controlled by the federal government. And so for these states west of the Mississippi, the question of the 10th Amendment of the nature of their sovereignty is inextricably bound up with the question of who can exercise jurisdiction over federal lands. What's fascinating about the City of Tombstone's case is that it involves indeed the historic City of Tombstone. You may have heard of Wyatt Earp and the OK Corral. Well, that's exactly the city that is involved. It's in Old City, the first chartered city in Arizona, and in fact, it was established during the 1880s, and at that time, it would not have existed but for its water supply in the Huachuca Mountains. The Huachuca Mountains are close to the Mexico border. Wyatt Earp and others associated with the leaders of the city reached out to that area and developed a water supply with a company called the Huachuca Water Company in the early 1880s and ran a 26-mile pipeline to the city. And since then, Tombstone's very existence as a town has depended on it. Fast forward 100 years. In July of 2011, the Monument Fire raged across the Huachuca Mountains. This was a disastrous fire. It burned so many trees down that it looks like a moonscape even to this day. As a result of denuding the mountains, when the monsoon season came, which is typical of the western states and the desert areas, the water had nothing to trap it, nothing to drain it into the soil, and it just created massive mudslides that just completely wiped out the City of Tombstone's municipal water supply and infrastructure. And so naturally, the City of Tombstone applied to the governor and declared a local state of emergency, got out there with equipment and machinery to try to fix their infrastructure. The governor of Arizona, Governor Brewer, issued a declaration of emergency authorizing and funding that effort. And in response, the U.S. Forest Service ordered them, in some cases with gentlemen on the ground toting guns, to stop restoring their water system. And they put the City of Tombstone in a position where, having lost 50% or more of its water supply, a water supply without which the city would never have been founded and never would have been sustained, the city was forced to beg and plead with the Forest Service to reestablish the essential water infrastructure that it needed to exist. And it brought a lawsuit, initially somewhat inartfully, trying to get a preliminary injunction to to get in there and fix the water supply using mechanized and motorized equipment under the authority of the state of emergency issued by the governor. That was denied, and we got involved after the fact at the Goldwater Institute to bring up what we think are the critical 10th Amendment issues in this case. And what I want to focus on really quickly before turning it over to Peter, and I don't want to talk forever, is the central issue in this case that we are taking to the U.S. Supreme Court. We should have our petition for writ of certiorari filed in a week or two. The central issue in this case is whether state and local governments, like the city of Tombstone, should be free under the 10th Amendment to restore their own essential infrastructure after a natural disaster, which is authorized by a gubernatorially declared state of emergency without begging the permission of intransigent federal authorities. We believe that this absolutely has to be answered in the affirmative if the U.S. Supreme Court meant what it said in its recent series of 10th Amendment cases beginning in the late 1980s, but most recently, if it meant what it said in Alden versus Maine. You may recall Alden versus Maine is the case where the Supreme Court held that the principles underlying the 11th Amendment's immunity or sovereign immunity for the states implied that the framework of the Constitution barred any federal action that threatened the continued existence of the states. We believe that that principle clearly applies here, where you have a desert town that is fully dependent on water supply in an area that is surrounded by federal lands. The continued existence of the state through its political subdivisions depends on the freedom to fully restore that water supply during a declared state of emergency after a natural disaster. And so our ultimate goal in this case is to test the seriousness of the court and to apply the principle of Alden versus Maine and to urge the court to recognize that no city, no town, no county, no state can be threatened with disaster within their own jurisdiction by the federal government without running afoul of the structure and purpose of our federal constitution, which is to guarantee the continued existence of the states. And there's a lot more to it, but at this point, I probably should turn it over to Peter.
Well, thank you, Nick. And I want to thank everyone at the Federalist Society for inviting me to speak today. I really appreciate the Federalist Society reaching out to have debates and discussion with people from different perspectives. I clearly have a different perspective than Nick, but nevertheless, I've participated in Federalist Society debates here at the University of Georgia, and I think that these kinds of debates is constructive action to broaden the discussion. I should note that I was not involved in the Tombstone case, and I have not reviewed the entire record. So on some of the facts, Nick has an upper hand on me. I have reviewed the briefs that were filed in the Ninth Circuit, and I think after reviewing all of that, it's not surprising to me that the Ninth Circuit affirmed the district court's denial of the preliminary injunction in an unpublished decision, because the law in this area is abundantly clear. In my remarks today, I'm going to briefly talk about some of the things that Nick didn't mention. Specifically, I'm going to talk very briefly about the property clause and the federal government's power over what is, after all, its own property. And then I'll talk about the 10th Amendment implications that that has. And if I have time remaining, and I don't want to take up too much time, I'll talk about the specific rules that are at issue in this case with a focus on the Wilderness Act, which Nick didn't mention, but it's an area where I've actually done some scholarship. The property clause provides that Congress shall have the power to make needful rules and regulations for the territory and other property of the United States. Originally, the property clause was designed to deal with land grants from the original 13 colonies, which were then granted to the United States. And as the United States expanded, so did the property that it owned. And one of the things I noted in Nick's remarks is that he said that this is a land that's controlled by the United States. And that's not true. This is land that is owned in fee by the United States. And I know that many of the people on this call are interested in so-called property rights. In this area, the United States is not just a proprietor, although it is a proprietor, but it is also a sovereign. In almost every case that the United States Supreme Court has looked at the power that the federal government has over its land that it owns in fee. They've defined the power broadly. In an early case, United States versus Gradio, which is from 1840, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the United States did not have to dispose of these lands, but instead could lease them out and hold them as a proprietor within the states. In U.S. versus City of San Francisco, a case that was discussed in the briefs, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the power that the United States has over its property under the property clause is a power without limitation. That was the phrase that they used, without limitation. In fact, the only case from the Supreme Court that interprets the property clause narrowly is Dred Scott. And Nick, in the discussion, if you want to defend Dred Scott, you're more than welcome to, if you want to. But every other case defines it broadly, says it's a plenary power, and defines the United States as a proprietor, not and a sovereign. So when we get to where Nick was focusing, which is, well, what about the 10th Amendment? And the 10th Amendment really has no application in this area. And I realize that that might be a controversial statement, but I think it's true. The Alden versus Maine case that Nick identified is inapplicable here. That was where the Congress was trying to get state courts to allow jurisdiction over certain federal actions within state court. This is not related to the federal government controlling its own property. And remember that what the city of Tombstone was trying to do was restore and develop certain water resources that are on federal lands. A way of thinking about this is, and it's not a great analogy, but it's the best I could come up with, is to think of federal property within the states, and I realize that many of the western states have a large proportion of their property that's owned by the federal government, but think of that federal property as like embassies in foreign lands. This isn't the state anymore in some ways. It's the federal government. It's the United States. Now, Congress can, in its wisdom, subject lands to state control that it owns, and the Supreme Court has also recognized that where Congress hasn't spoken, state law governs, and it recognized that in the Kleppe case. Nevertheless, where Congress has spoken, then the typical principles under the Supremacy Clause govern, and that means that federal law is supreme. Here, the Congress has spoken through several laws that are relevant to the Tombstone case. They are the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, the Endangered Species Act, and the Wilderness Act, which is what I'm going to focus on because I think it's probably the most central part of Tombstone's complaint against the United States. The Wilderness Act, Congress said, in a wilderness area, which this is part of as part of the Coronado National Forest, Congress said that except as specifically provided for in this act, there can be no permanent roads, and there can't be the use of motor vehicles, motorized equipment, except as necessary to meet minimum requirements for the administration of the wilderness area. Now, here, from what I can tell from the briefs, the Forest Service was making an evaluation as to whether it could allow motorized equipment, motorized uses, motor vehicles, because Congress had said, this is a special area, and these are the rules that apply. So regardless of Governor Brewer's declaration of an emergency, that's irrelevant. What's relevant is what Congress has said about the lands that the United States owns. And here, from what I'm able to tell from the briefs, Congress has said this is a wilderness area, and the Forest Service was simply evaluating its decisions about how to allow Tombstone to reestablish water uses consistent with the rules that Congress had established for lands owned by the United States. And so again, as I started out with, it's not surprising to me that the district court denied the motion for a preliminary injunction and that the Ninth Circuit affirmed that decision in an unpublished decision, because to me, the law is exceptionally clear in this area. And with that, I don't want to take up too much time. I do want to leave time for Q&A, so I'll conclude.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. Let's turn to the audience for questions. In a moment, you'll hear an announcement that the floor mode is on. Once you hear that, to ask a question, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So I do want to get to the audience. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to the audience, I'm going to give Mr. Drenius a minute or two to respond to Professor Appel's argument.
Yeah, unfortunately, Peter's wrong about a couple of things. The City of Tombstone's water system, it predates any designation of a national forest, and in fact is a property owned by the city in a limited fee interest nature. The source of that authority is the famous 1866 Mining Act, also known as RS 2339 and 2340. It also produces a road right-of-way authority under 2447. But the bottom line is the forest designation carved out explicitly any lands encumbered by previously existing valid claims. That was an express provision in the designation of this forest, and what Tombstone held from the 1880s should have been treated as an inholding, subject only to the jurisdiction of the county, except for dealing with marginal disputes over the scope of the activities that are authorized by those rights. So let's be very clear. The City of Tombstone owns limited fee interests to draw water and to maintain a water infrastructure in the National Forest, which are not themselves within the jurisdiction of the Forest Service. And what the Forest Service is trying to do is exercise jurisdiction not only where they have no jurisdiction, but in the midst of a natural disaster where the town's very existence is at stake. And when I say that, I'm not being hyperbolic. The U.S. Supreme Court, in an overturned decision, a decision from about 1937 called Brush, ruled that the federal government could not even tax the income of a guy working for a municipal water supply because of the dangerous precedent that would establish should the federal government decide to tax excessively. The court said that it would threaten, in a very real sense, the very existence of the city, and therefore was not a proper tax under the structure of the Constitution. So let me just end by highlighting the 50,000-foot point here. Congress can pass any law that it wants. It can cite any provision of the Constitution as authority for that law, but in the bottom line analysis that the court articulated in Alden versus Maine is the court still has to look at the structure of the Constitution and its implicit guarantee of dual sovereignty that's meaningful, and ask, even if Congress invokes the right magic words or the right portions of the Constitution to justify their laws, is this in fact consistent with the underlying principle that's interwoven throughout the Constitution of the continued existence of the states? If it's not, then it's unconstitutional, period, because otherwise we do not have a real system of dual sovereignty. And in this unique set of facts, after a natural disaster, when the water supply of a town that would not exist but for this water supply is at stake, in the context of a gubernatorially declared state of emergency, it simply cannot be seriously disputed that the continued existence of the state through its charter city political subdivision is at issue. And so the fundamental question that for some reason still has not been grappled with has to be addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court. Did the U.S. Supreme Court in Alden versus Maine lay down a principle that extends beyond just the question of whether or not a state can be sued in its own courts by private litigants? Did it in fact articulate a principle that subjects every claimed federal power or federal legislation to a test? Does this threaten the continued existence of the states or not? If in fact Alden versus Maine does that, if in fact Alden versus Maine requires the court to assess with regard to any federal legislation, no matter how it is premised on being invoked under the property clause or the commerce clause or anything else, if there has to be a threshold test asking whether this threatens the continued existence of the states or not, that test has been met here without a doubt. A desert town's water supply has been disrupted by a natural disaster. Its continued existence is at stake. The viability of a state as a sovereign body is at issue, particularly in the western states where 70% of their lands are controlled by the federal government, where there is inevitably essential infrastructure needed for their existence located on those lands. So for our position, this case is about a very fundamental question. Is the Supreme Court going to enforce as a general principle the ideas that it articulated in Alden versus Maine?
Well, let's go back to Professor Appel now and give him a minute or two. I'm particularly interested, Professor, about the factual matter of the state having an inholding within the forest system.
And here, Dean, this is where, because I've not reviewed the whole record, I'm a little bit at a disadvantage. My understanding from the Justice Department's brief and the brief filed by Tombstone is that there might be some dispute about exactly how many of these water sources are actually proprietary to Tombstone. But I don't think that that's necessarily relevant to the points I was trying to make. It's very clear from the Supreme Court precedent and from the applicable precedent in the Ninth Circuit that even if Tombstone has a private property right, there's also a property right that the United States owns. And the line of cases is very consistent that if the United States is the proprietor of where Tombstone wants to go, then the laws of the United States, like the Wilderness Act, NEPA, the Endangered Species Act, all apply. And that the regulatory power, and this is where the property of the United States is a little bit different, because, of course, the United States is not just a common proprietor, but also a sovereign, that the regulatory power of the United States is applicable. And so this has been consistent with mining claims within wilderness in national forest areas. This has been consistent with water claims in national forests, national parks, within wilderness areas. The courts have been pretty uniform about this. And so I understand Nick's point about the pressure on Tombstone. And again, I'm not representing the United States. I'm simply looking at this as best as I can as a legal issue. It's unfortunate, I guess, for Tombstone that they're dealing with a proprietor who is also a sovereign, who has commands by Congress that they have to follow. And so when I looked at the briefs in the case, it looked like the Forest Service did try to expedite reviews, did try to work with Tombstone, but at the same time, it's got a boss it's got to respond to, which is Congress. And of course, if the Forest Service cut corners or just allowed Tombstone to do whatever it wanted to do, then it would be facing a lawsuit from environmental plaintiffs saying you're doing the wrong thing on public lands. So it seems to me that while Tombstone's interests are not insignificant, nevertheless, they're dealing with land owned in fee by a proprietor and a sovereign, namely the United States. And the Supreme Court has said that the power that Congress has over lands owned by the United States are plenary and without limitation.
Very good. Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts in the audience, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We have one question at this point, and then our lines will be open. Let's go to our first caller question.
Hello. Yes, this is Linda Doa. How are you? Very good discussion. I wanted to basically reiterate that a state is a sovereign, and that should take precedent over any federal encroachment. And as you all know, this is the United States of America. So I find it appalling that the federal government would attempt to encroach in this manner. especially when you're dealing with such a vital issue with respect to Tombstone's survival. So I'd like to have you all address that point, that less federal government is better. So this is quite contrary to that philosophy when you have an attempt to exercise power in this manner. So how would you address that concern?
Who wants to respond to that?
Well, I'd like to just take a crack at that, because I am obviously ideologically sympathetic with that point of view. But I don't think this is just an ideological perspective. If you look at, again, Alden versus Maine, the central message of the Supreme Court is that interwoven into the very fabric of the Constitution is, no matter what else it may say, the guarantee of the continued existence of the states as viable sovereign bodies. So that means that no matter how many articles that you can point to justify a piece of federal legislation, if that piece of federal legislation undermines the continued existence of the states as viable sovereign bodies, it's unconstitutional. And the question that our case poses is, did the court mean what it said? Here are a set of facts where I freely admit the case law, if you look at it narrowly, without looking at it from the perspective of the principle articulated in Alden versus Maine, are very, very difficult. But if you look at the facts in light of the principle articulated in Alden versus Maine, it is clear. The state's continued existence through its charter political subdivision is at issue. It is at issue by virtue of the state declaring a state of emergency. It is at issue by virtue of the fact that historically Tombstone would not exist without this water supply. So since it is clearly at issue, does the court mean what it says when it says that the structure, the nature, the implicit premises of the Constitution all stand against any kind of federal legislation that might threaten the continued existence of the state? And I believe that the court will rule that federal legislation cannot go that far, no matter how many articles it cites as its authority. It cannot extinguish or threaten to extinguish the existence of a state through its political subdivisions.
Professor Appel?
This is Peter Appel. You know, this is I think a central disagreement that I have with Nick and I have with the caller, because I think that the area of property owned by the United States, which Alden versus Maine had nothing to do with, is a very distinct one. If you go back to United States versus Gradio, all the way back to 1840, the Supreme Court said that there was nothing that was inconsistent with the United States retaining proprietorship of land within a state. There was nothing inconsistent without that, and that the United States could hold that land in perpetuity. Now, we can have debates about should we have more federal government, less federal government, whatever. We can have debates about should the United States sell all of the lands that it owns. And it owns about 28% of the land mass of the United States. We can have that debate, and that's up to the judgment of Congress. But when the United States owns these lands as both proprietor and sovereign, I think cases like Alden versus Maine, which Nick keeps citing, have nothing to do with this, because this is talking about the property of the United States, which the Supreme Court from 1840 all the way to now has consistently, with the one exception of Dred Scott, consistently interpreted as being a power, quote, without limitation. And they have heard these Tenth Amendment arguments before and rejected them. So I don't think Alden versus Maine has any import here.
You know, let me just briefly respond to that with just this comment. Again, the fundamental question was whether or not Alden versus Maine articulating a principle that applies across the board to the entire structure of the Constitution. Is it a constitutional principle that the federal government may not threaten the continued existence of the states? That is the issue that we want to squarely put before the U.S. Supreme Court under a set of facts where no one can seriously dispute that the continued existence of the state through its political subdivision is at stake.
All right. We have one more caller question at this point. If you have a question for our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our next caller, let me make a brief commercial announcement. Tomorrow, we'll host a Teleforum conference call at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Bronx household litigation, which is a Second Circuit case concerning the after-hours use of school property, public school property, for worship. And we've got a full schedule of calls so far for next week. On Tuesday, we're going to host a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum. Professor Adam Mossoff and Doug Nelson will be attending oral argument in the Bowman versus Monsanto Supreme Court case, which looks at reverse payments in patent cases. That's Tuesday at 2 p.m. On Wednesday, we're going to take a broader look at recess appointments in the wake of the Noel Canning case. Joining us for that call will be Rachel Brand, Howard Radsley, and John Elwood. That's Wednesday at 2 p.m. Then on Thursday, we're going to be talking about national security and intelligence leaks. That's Thursday at noon. And then finally on Friday, our topic is going to be federal criminal prosecutions. We'll be featuring Conrad Black, Bill Otis, and Ellen Podgor on that call. That's Friday at 2 p.m. For a complete schedule of upcoming calls, you can visit the Federalist Society's Teleforum webpage. And I also want to mention that it's we've noted here a couple times the amount of public land owned, especially in the western states, by the federal government. We do have one of our older Teleforum conference calls, which is now available online as a podcast on our site that specifically talks about the future of publicly owned lands. And you can get to that on our Federalist Society website as well. We now have two questions pending, so let's go to our next caller.
Good afternoon. My name is Thelma Tormina, and I'm not an attorney. I run an educational nonprofit. My question is, in regards to all of this, how does the federal government justify destroying a town and the people that live within it under the Constitution? I mean, I just don't understand, I guess, how they can do that with the constitutional rights. Aren't they supposed to uphold the Constitution?
Who wants to take a shot at that question?
This is Peter Appel. I'll start with that. A couple of things, and I know that Nick is going to disagree with me. I'm basing this just on reading the briefs that were filed. The district court found, contrary to Nick's repeated invocation of this, which I've not tried to dispute with him simply because I don't know all of the facts, the district court found, and the Ninth Circuit upheld, that there wasn't any kind of extreme danger facing the town of Tombstone. But I think the more important point is that the reason that the federal government is doing what it's doing, and again, they're not saying that Tombstone can't get water. What they're saying is you have to go by the rules that apply to our lands if you want to repair the water sources that you have. And they're doing that because Congress said so. And what Congress says with regard to the lands that the United States owns is what goes. And under our Constitution, under the Supremacy Clause, that's what governs. And it doesn't matter that a governor has declared a state of emergency or whatever. We're talking about an area that is owned by the United States and has been declared to be a wilderness area, and that has been in the judgment of Congress to be the best disposition of these lands. That power of Congress is something that goes back to the founding. The lands that the United States owned were originally lands that were granted to the United States by the original colonies. They were originally for the benefit of all of the people of the United States. That has been the common understanding since the founding. So the 10th Amendment arguments that Nick is making and his repeated discussion about Alden versus Maine and some implications of that case, which I think might be reading it a little bit too broadly, but that's getting beyond the scope of our conversation, really don't apply here.
I'd like to drill down into the case just a little bit, just to respond to the assertion that the district court found that there was not a significant risk. The district court's decision really was pretty conclusory. It didn't identify any specific findings of fact. It just stated things without any reference to the evidence. Most significantly, on the issue of the threat to the city of Tombstone, is the fact that the Forest Service itself repeatedly admitted and recognized the threat to public health and safety that existed in allowing the city of Tombstone to use hand tools and some mechanized equipment to restore three of its 25 spring sites. 13% of its water supply. So the critical piece of evidence that never received any comment whatsoever from the district court was the admissions of the Forest Service that public health and safety was at issue, that the safe potable water and water needs for fire suppression were at issue. These are things that are in the administrative findings of the Forest Service itself, and yet the district court simply, in a conclusory fashion, said, there's nothing there. The Ninth Circuit, in a very interesting decision, although it did affirm the lower court's decision, it specifically said that it was not reaching any other issue other than the 10th Amendment issue we raised. So I look at that as not really affirming anything that the district court did, but simply trying to tee up the 10th Amendment issue that I've been articulating for the Supreme Court to decide. The Ninth Circuit felt that its hands were bound in a certain respect because there isn't any directly on-point guidance. There are only the principles that the U.S. Supreme Court has articulated in Alden versus Maine and in other cases. And so the Ninth Circuit teed this case up to the U.S. Supreme Court. It asked the Supreme Court to provide the guidance that it felt it did not already have. So this case is, I think, incredibly attractive for the U.S. Supreme Court to take. It is at an early stage of the litigation, yes, but if we don't have this issue decided now, it will radically change the course of the case because we don't know how to handle the overall litigation. Do we treat it as a simple property rights matter? Because of the fact that these water rights and rights of way predate the Forest Service, predate the forest designation, are not subject to the jurisdiction of the Forest Service, and that the Forest Service is therefore engaging in a regulatory taking, which is completely unauthorized? Or do we proceed ahead with developing and proving the true threat to public health and safety that this sort of interference represents? You know, our petition for certiorari is going to raise that question to the U.S. Supreme Court and point out that there could never be a better time for the U.S. Supreme Court to provide guidance for this case and for many, many other cases like this case throughout the western states, because it turns out that these 1866 Mining Act rights, which establish mining rights, water rights, rights of way, road rights of way, the Forest Service is disregarding these rights, these ancient rights, pretty much throughout the western states. And they're treating them as if they don't mean anything anymore, even though they are just as congressionally rooted as anything that they're relying on today. And I think that the U.S. Supreme Court's going to recognize what's attractive about this case is its implications of that kind of disrespect for property rights. This is not just a proprietary issue. This implicates sovereignty when we're talking about essential infrastructure during a natural disaster in a state where 70% of its lands are not under its control.
All right, we've got two questions pending at this point. Again, if you have a question for either of our experts, you need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone to join the queue. Let's go to our next question.
Hi, Nick. This is Steve Klein from the Wyoming Liberty Group, and I heard you mention earlier some of the old revised statutes from back in the day of Western settlement, and I was just curious if RS 2477 has come up in any way. That's an old law that allows rights of way over federal land, and that wasn't foreclosed until 1976. And they've had a lot of success with that in Utah. We're finally bringing state law up to speed here in Wyoming. And I was wondering if Tombstone had considered possibly finding some old rights of way to get their power equipment up the mountain.
Well, thanks, Steve. Yes. Well, the 1866 Mining Act had a number of provisions which were separately codified under different numbers. It turns out that that is the same act that provides authority for recognizing water rights under RS 2339 and for recognizing public highway rights of way under RS 2447. So, You know, these are related congressional enactments, and if you look at the case law, the courts have drawn on precedent relating to the water rights portion to provide guidance with respect to the public highway portion and vice versa. So these are very intimately connected concepts when it comes to determining whether or not these sorts of rights of way exist across federal lands. And in our case, we do believe that there are public highway rights of way that were confirmed by the County Board of Supervisors in 1901 that allow for access to our water rights and our water rights of way, which include pipelines. And, you know, the challenge there is that to have that question determined, we have to have the district court, you know, actually grapple with it. And one of the challenges we've had is that because the district court did not issue any specific findings of fact, it didn't even address the RS 2447 issue. And so for purposes of this petition for certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court, we're really going to focus on the 10th Amendment issue, which is most plainly at issue when dealing with the water rights side. Because as important as RS 2447 public highways are, we think that the connection between the continued existence of the state and its political subdivision from the RS 2339 water rights is much more essential and much more persuasive. So our focus on for at least the petition for certiorari is going to be almost entirely on the deprivation of free and full restoration of our long-standing water rights and water rights related rights of way.
All right, Professor Appel, did you have anything on this point?
Two brief points. One specific, one more general. The specific point is, regardless of what rights Tombstone might have under the 1866 Act, the courts have been very clear that that's not a abandonment of the federal government's power to regulate those. That's been very clearly recognized with regard to mining rights, roads, et cetera. The broader point is, getting back to the point I've been reiterating through the course of this conversation, which is, by talking about the rights granted by the 1866 Act, there is implicit in that it's Congress, the federal government, that has the power to regulate what's going to happen on its lands. Congress didn't have to pass that act. Now, having passed that act, then there are questions about, okay, well, what rights remain, how far can regulation go, et cetera, et cetera. But the more important point is that Congress could have made the judgment in 1866, you know what? We're not going to open these lands for settlement. We're not going to open them for mining. We're not going to open them for roads. And that would be the judgment of Congress, which the Supreme Court would say, well, that's your choice.
Okay. It looks like we have one final question. Still time for more questioners. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. But for now, let's go to what seems to be the final question.
Hi, this is Tyler Ward from Vermont Law School. My question is, does the equal footing doctrine have a role to play in any of this?
Well, Peter, if you don't mind, we considered that theory. It's a challenging theory to even more challenging theory to advance. What you're referring to is the idea that when states are admitted from, subsequent to the ratification of the Constitution, when states are admitted subsequently to that, carved out of territorial lands, they're supposed to be admitted on an equal footing with the original 13 states. And that is an ancient argument, and the argument that is an ancient argument that is that what that means is that they have to have all of the rights, privileges, authorities, sovereignties in exactly the same way as the original 13 states. And applied to a case like this, the argument would be that the mere fact that the federal government has retained control over 70% of its lands categorically treats the western states as a different kind of entity in a significant way than the original 13 states, that it deprives them of essential attributes of sovereignty and so forth. All of this is a very plausible argument to me. I think is probably from an original understanding of the equal footing doctrine correct. The problem is it's been blown away by the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, squarely for over 100 years. So, you pick your battles where you've got a foothold, and unfortunately for the equal footing doctrine, we didn't see much of a foothold for that specific theory. I think what we see in the court's recent 10th Amendment cases, though, is a much more solid way of thinking about this particular case. The idea that implicit in the Constitution that that conditioning all claims of federal power is the guarantee that states are shall continue to exist in a meaningful sovereign capacity. That, to me, is a much more lively, active legal principle to try to enforce, which is why we have focused our case on it. Moreover, the principles that that Peter's articulating, this idea that there's a federal plenary power under the property clause, that is increasingly under siege. I mean, it used to be that the federal government had a plenary spending power, and then we saw in the Affordable Health Care Act that now the federal government's spending power is limited by the 10th Amendment. It used to be that the federal government had a plenary treaty power, and we saw that in Bond versus United States. The Supreme Court was willing to entertain 10th Amendment claims against the use of the treaty power. We actually believe at the Goldwater Institute that this use of the term plenary federal power is a term that is outdated, that it was never consistent with the original understanding of the Constitution, of which the federal government is supposed to have limited and enumerated powers, not plenary powers. And we believe that it's on its way out, and we want to help it on its way out with a case like City of Tombstone versus United States.
Thank you.
This is Peter Appel. Just to respond briefly, the short answer is no. The equal footing doctrine has no applicability here. I know that Nick was more reluctant to maybe get there and was saying, well, you got to pick your battles. But he was correct in saying that the Supreme Court has rejected equal footing arguments for a long time. The equal footing doctrine, with one exception, has been basically limited to the ownership that states have when they're admitted to the Union over submerged lands. The word equal footing appears nowhere in the Constitution. The case law which develops the equal footing doctrine says that it's implied that every state is admitted on equal footing, but where they've applied it has been, as I said, with one exception, has been with regard to submerged lands under navigable waters. And the one exception is when Oklahoma was admitted to the Union, Congress said that it had to keep its capital at Guthrie. I don't even know where Guthrie, Oklahoma is, and the Oklahoma for a period of time. And before that period of time expired, the Oklahoma legislature decided to move the capital to Oklahoma City. And the folks in Guthrie were not happy about that. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, you can't tell a state that's now a sovereign where its state capital has to be. And they use the equal footing language to justify that. I don't have a problem with that result, but as Nick pointed out, when it comes to the ownership of federal lands within the states, the Supreme Court has long ago rejected the application of the equal footing doctrine as being violated by the ownership of federal property within the states. And I would disagree with Nick because, going again back to, you know, United States versus Gradio, 1840, the Supreme Court said it's perfectly fine for the United States to own property, retain perpetual ownership, manage the property as it wants to within states that are admitted to the Union.
We're apparently touching a couple nerves here. We've got two more questions and about 10 minutes, so I'm going to ask the callers to be concise with their questions if they could. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, good afternoon. I am not an attorney, but I am a federal worker, and I want to thank you for putting this very interesting teleform on. My question is, well, I'm hearing that the Forest Service said no because Endangered Species Act was invoked and NEPA was invoked. I'm not sure if I got this right. And I'd like to know, is that really the issue? And if it is, why don't they just, if they did a NEPA document and did their endangered species consultation, I mean, I can't believe it has even gotten to the point where it's so bad that we're even going to the Supreme Court. Would that resolve it? Are you waiting for, I mean, if they did a document, would that allow things to move forward and resolve the issue?
Well, Peter, I guess this is more in the weeds, so I'll take that.
Go ahead.
Actually, it's very unclear why the Forest Service, what regulatory authority the Forest Service is relying upon in denying us access. If you look at, you know, if you look at their decision memoranda, the regulatory documents that they generated, the only point in their own decision memoranda where you see any reasoning for why they won't let us restore more than three of our 25 spring sites is in reference to a cultural, historical, consultation where their archaeologist said that he didn't want them to restore any spring sites that didn't look like they were in recent use. And so from a strictly on the record analysis to this day, the best explanation we have for what the Forest Service is doing is apparently based on the advice of their archaeologist as part of the NEPA review, not to touch anything else other than these three spring sites, which is incredibly curious because at the same time that their archaeologist is trying to preserve those other sites, I guess for the benefit of history, they've been denying that we've ever established them. and so it's just a very curious thing. Now, you know, the one interesting thing about the law in this case is when it comes to water rights, there really is no federal law that, as a matter of field preemption, displaces state jurisdiction or political subdivision jurisdiction over water within the states. In fact, to the contrary, all of the federal laws impacting water rights and water use in the western states have carefully carved out and preserved concurrent jurisdiction for the states. And so one of the very, very curious things about our case, if you want to get into the statutory interpretation weeds, is that there really is no federal law that squarely stands against the restoration work that that the city of Tombstone wants to do. In fact, all of the enabling authorities that the Forest Service is relying upon that have been articulated in the case seem to want to protect our existing water rights. In a lot of ways, you know, the way that we view this case is this is sort of the rogue conduct of an administrative agency that is not even looking to the plain meaning of its own authorizing statutes and certainly not doing so with sensitivity to the federalism interests at issue in this case. Now that approach to me is not, you know, as satisfying as raising the more fundamental question, which is, does the city of Tombstone have any right to exist under the 10th Amendment? Because that to me is the fundamental when you're disrupting a water supply, and that's the issue we're going to try to take to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Professor Appel, do you want to weigh in here before we go to our next caller?
Yeah, and I'll be really brief. The one thing that Nick didn't mention is that there are considerations about what the Forest Service was doing under the Wilderness Act. And again, Nick has, you know, much more knowledge of the record of this case than I do, because I was not involved in the litigation in this case. But there is the Wilderness Act, and that's some of the reason why the Forest Service was saying trying to regulate some of the ways that it was going to permit Tombstone to repair the three well sites that it did allow.
Let's go to our final question.
Yes, this is John Wright in Billings, Montana. I was wondering about the application of the McCarran Amendment and adjudication of federal reserved water rights in this situation and whether this is really just a state court issue that's dragged into federal court.
Hey, that's a great question. Sorry, Peter, I just got to jump on that. It's not the McCarran Amendment basically says that you can join the federal government to a water rights adjudication should you file it in federal court. But if there's an existing water rights adjudication in state court, then federal courts, or at least courts have interpreted that as requiring federal courts to abstain on adjudicating water rights and to wait for state courts to proceed. What's important about our case, though, is that we're not asking to adjudicate water rights. What we're trying to get is the right of way to restore essential infrastructure. And that is not a question that is among the issues that can be decided in a state court-based water adjudication. The state court-based water adjudication deals with relative rights between adverse claimants and their priorities. It's sort of like a debate among creditors over who has priority in some collateral. That is a complete side issue to our case, and unfortunately, it has been raised as sort of a defense by the Forest Service. It hasn't gotten a whole lot of traction, isn't even referenced in the Ninth Circuit's decision. But here's the bottom line. The bottom line is it doesn't matter who has priority interests or whose rights come first in the use of the water. What we are trying to do is simply exercise the right to put down the pipeline and restore the infrastructure that was swept away in a natural disaster.
Professor Attell?
I'll just comment very briefly on that. I don't have a lot of disagreement with Nick on the substance of the McCarran Amendment and how that applies here. And of course, he knows the record much better than I do. I know that there has, from the briefs, that there has been a disagreement between the Forest Service and Tombstone about exactly where the water rights are. But as Nick pointed out, this isn't a water rights case. And so the McCarran Amendment doesn't have a whole lot of applicability. What I will point out is, and this just gets back to one of the themes that I've been trying to articulate in today's discussion. The McCarran Amendment was a judgment by Congress to waive the sovereign immunity of the United States for general stream adjudications and allow the United States to be sued in state courts. Congress didn't have to do that. Similarly, Congress could make the choice that it wasn't going to create a wilderness area. They made the opposite choice. They are making decisions about the sovereignty and the sovereign property of the United States. And if Congress had never passed the McCarran Amendment, the United States would never be showing up in state court. And that's just simply the principles that have been operating under the Constitution since the time of the founding.
Thank you very much, Professor Peter Appel, Mr. Nick Dranius. We certainly appreciate you joining our call today and sharing your thoughts. This has been a stimulating debate and discussion. I want to thank our audience as well for your thoughtful questions and invite you to join us for our teleform conference call tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number when we'll be discussing the Bronx household case in the Second Circuit. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.